In February, the High Court ruled in the dispute between Canary Wharf and its tenant, the European Medicines Agency, over the impact of Brexit on the EMA's lease. We're recording this podcast on the morning of 29th March 2019, the original planned date for the UK to leave the EU. And this ruling remains the only actual decision of note relating to Brexit thus far. However, it is not the end of the story. The EMA has been granted permission to appeal, which means battle lines may again be drawn at the Court of Appeal, perhaps later this year. We here at EG like to call in experts to explain the arguments and implications of major cases. And in this instance, we could not ask for guests with greater expertise. I am joined by two of the leading barristers in property law, each of whom actually acts for one of the parties in these proceedings. Joanne Wicks QC, representing Canary Wharf, and Jonathan Seatler QC, representing the EMA. Neither one is a stranger to our studio, so welcome back again this morning, Joanne and Jonathan.
Great to be here. Thanks Hi. Very much.
So, to begin with, could you just, Joanne, perhaps remind us of the background facts to this case and what the central issue is?
Sure. So, the European Medicines Agency is an agency of the EU which regulates medicines, and it has a 25-year lease of premises in Canary Wharf, which was granted in 2014 without a break clause. And just to give you a bit of sense of scale, this is a significantly large building. It's got basement, ground, promenade, floors, and then about 20 floors above. And the EMA occupies up to level 10 and pays £30 million a year in rent. So one of the significant features was that the agency was a pre-let tenant. That is to say that it came on board before this building was built. And from Canary Wharf's perspective, that was significant because it enabled the landlord to be sure that it had a 25-year income stream, which enabled it to build the building. From the EMA's point of view, it could have some input into the building and it could fit out the premises in a bespoke way for itself, and it could also get a very substantial package of inducements because it was taking a long lease without a break clause. Now, I'm sure some listeners might know that in March 2017, the Prime Minister served a notice under Article 50 that the UK was withdrawing from the EU, and not long after that, in August 2017, the agency wrote to its landlords saying that it would treat Brexit as a ground of frustration of the lease, and that means that the lease would come to an end when the UK leaves the EU. Now, plans were made for the agency to move to Amsterdam, and that relocation was confirmed by an EU regulation in November 2018, and in fact they finished their move whilst we were having the trial in January 2019. In the meantime, the landlords tried hard to persuade the agency to take a different stance, but it wasn't possible to reach consensus, and reluctantly the landlords brought proceedings to have it determined by the court whether or not Brexit would frustrate this lease. That claim was expedited because of the potential effect on the property market, and so the key issue is, will the lease be put to an end by Brexit?
So Joanne's mentioned that word frustration, and I was at the Property Litigation Association conference last week where, Jonathan, you gave an entertaining talk as part of which you expertly summed up how that doctrine of frustration works. So could we ask you, perhaps with a little less specialist audience in mind, to go over that again for us this morning?
Yeah, absolutely. There are four elements to any claim for frustration. What the person claiming frustration has got to show is, number one, that there's a supervening event. That means something that happens after the creation of the contract that zooms in from outside. A supervening event, that's the first characteristic. The second characteristic is it must be neither party's fault. A party can't have their fingerprints on the event which causes the supposed frustration of the contract. So it's a supervening event, one, which is neither party's fault, two, and three, it must be unprovided for by the contract. If there's a clause which regulates that particular event, then it's not going to be an act of frustration. It's going to be something catered for by the contract. So a supervening event, neither party's fault, which is unprovided for by the contract, and then fourthly, which creates an unforeseeably radically different deal which it's just unfair to hold the parties to. An unforeseeably radically different deal, which it's unfair to hold the parties to. And what's interesting about the Canary Wharf EMA case was that each one of those aspects of that definition were engaged. And that's one of the reasons why it's so interesting. The other reason it's so interesting is because there are actually fairly few frustration cases that are reported over the years. This is not something that happens very often. But those are the four elements.
And as you say, it is a doctrine that applies in, shall we say, exceptional cases and never before successfully in relation to a lease. Is that correct?
That's right. The law is that a lease can be frustrated. There's a case called National Carriers and Panalpina, which says the lease can be frustrated, although it wasn't in that particular case. But there isn't a case yet in which a lease has been frustrated, although there's been some fairly close misses.
And so with that all in mind, so should we ask you, Jonathan, first to outline what the major arguments were on your side? You were, of course, arguing that in this case the lease would be frustrated.
Yeah. So let's look at those four elements. The first one, supervening event. We said that the supervening event was Brexit, and that Brexit completely changed the nature of the deal. And that obviously came along after the contract was made. The agreement for lease was August 2011. Mm-hmm. And we said that the whole Brexit thing only got going after August 2011. Then we said that it was neither party's fault. In particular, it wasn't our fault. We said that, yes, it's true that the European Union has ordered the EMA to relocate to Amsterdam, but they're different legal entities. That's not us, and that's European law, and we've got to abide by European law, which of course is incorporated into English law. Then the third element is unprovided for by the contract. We said this is not provided for by the contract because the alienation provisions, the rights to assign and sublet, were about a freedom to choose to leave and not a situation where it's imposed by law. And then fourthly, we said it creates an unforeseeably radically different deal, which it's unfair to hold the parties to. And in relation to that, we said, well, look, we can't occupy for ourselves after Brexit because we're constrained by EU law, which requires us to be in Amsterdam. We can't share because of the lease provisions. We can't use it for any other purpose. We've got no other purpose in London. We can't sublet because of ultra-virus, our capacity. And we can't assign because that would involve us giving an AGA, which it's outside our vires. It's outside the scope of our nature to give. And so those were the arguments. And it's right to say that the judge found in favour of Joanne's clients on each one of those four elements. What he did say, though, was that on the assumption that the EMA is right in all respects regarding its capacity, which he found they weren't, but if they were right on the capacity, then it would follow that given the inability to use the premises at all post-Brexit, the lease would be frustrated. So what he found was that if we were right in our analysis of the European law and of the vires and of the capacity, there would have been a frustration, but we weren't.
So a relatively close run thing. And Joanne, how would you sort of summarise how your client put the case?
I don't think I'd agree that it was a relatively close run thing. So essentially, our position on behalf of Canary Wharf Group was that we disagreed with a number of the sort of stepping stones in the agency's argument. So we disagreed with the argument that they didn't have capacity, and we disagreed with the arguments about what they said flowed from that lack of capacity, for example. But we had an overriding argument, which is that basically whatever the effect of Brexit, however hard or soft Brexit might be, it would not frustrate this lease. And that's because a lease like this is a 25-year property interest. And under that kind of interest, the tenant takes the risk of change over that 25-year period, including unforeseen changes in the law or in the political environment. And Brexit is just an example of the kinds of political or legal risks which a tenant agrees to take when it signs up to a lease at the start. And you've got a lease here which, like most commercial leases, or all commercial leases, is assignable, it's capable of being sublet, and that property interest remains. It's a valid estate in land which is not destroyed by Brexit. So the sorts of examples you see in the case law, as Jonathan says, there's been no case where a lease has ever been held to be frustrated, but some of the examples that have been thrown out by the judges along the way include things like earthquakes, where the land actually physically disappears, or a cottage falling into the sea, something like that. And our position is, look, Brexit, whatever its ramifications, is a really, really, really long way from anything like that. Yes, it may mean that the agency feels it's appropriate to relocate, and yes, that relocation may be expensive, but it doesn't put an end to the legal obligations which it signed up to at the start.
And Joanne, how would you summarise what the judge decided in this case?
Okay, so there were sort of two parts to the judge's decision, reflecting the way in which the EMA had put its arguments. So the first part is an argument that the lease was frustrated for supervening illegality, and that rests on the legal consequences of Brexit for the agency. And the second part was the agency's argument that there was a common purpose which had been frustrated by Brexit and by being forced to relocate. So in relation to the arguments about supervening illegality, the judge decided the agency was wrong to say that there was some kind of overriding legal requirement that EU agencies had to be located in member states. He said, well, there may be good practical or political reasons why they would want to be located in the EU, but there's not some kind of underlying principle of law. He said the agency was wrong to argue that it would lose its powers to hold and to use the property after Brexit, or to dispose of the property by way of subletting or assignment when the UK ceases to be a member state, and therefore it was not ultra vires, that is to say, not beyond the powers and capacity of the EMA to pay its rent and to meet its other obligations under the lease when the UK stops being a member state. But then he went on to say, even if he was wrong about that, even if the agency was right that it would lose its powers to pay rent and to hold and use the property under EU law, that wasn't relevant to the English law of frustration. And even if he was wrong about that too, that, as Jonathan says, he said, okay, if the agency were right that it couldn't use the premises, it couldn't dispose of the premises, but would still be stuck there effectively, then it's right that the lease would be frustrated. But the judge said, well, that would be as a consequence of the EU's decision to relocate the agency through this regulation that was passed in 2018. And it would have been quite straightforward for the EU to have made provision in that regulation at the same time for the agency to have the necessary powers. So if it got to that stage of the analysis, then any frustration will be what we call self-induced, that is to say, not something that the party has no control over, but something that flows from a consequence of a choice that they've made. And then in relation to the common purpose arguments, the judge said, well, this requires a sort of multifactorial approach. You look at all of the different circumstances and you ask, is there some kind of common purpose between these parties that exists outside this contract, outside this lease? Is there something which is fundamental to the basis of the agreement between them and not to be found in the lease? And when he looked at all the various factors, he said, no, there wasn't. There was no common purpose, as between both landlord and tenant, that the premises would be a permanent headquarters for the EMA over 25 years. When you look at the lease, he said, that allows the agency to sublet the whole, it allows the agency to assign. So the lease is expressly dealing with circumstances where the agency wants to completely relocate to a different premises, and it doesn't matter what the reason is, it doesn't matter that that happens to be Brexit or because it's some other reason. And when you look at the negotiations that took place for the lease and the other surrounding circumstances, he said the parties' interests aren't the same. There's no common purpose. They're actually in conflict. This is a commercial negotiation and both parties trying to protect their own particular interests.
Okay, so you both offered your own analysis of what the judge has decided, but that may not be the end of the road. The judge has granted the EMA permission to appeal. That doesn't necessarily mean that an appeal will go forth. But what can you tell us about what happens next?
Well, what we can say is that the EMA must trigger the appeal by the 15th of April.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does so, then the matter will proceed to the Court of Appeal.
And by the very nature of appeal proceedings, I imagine that the key arguments will be somewhat concentrated in the Court of Appeal compared to how they were below.
Well, one thing is that there won't be, if it goes to the Court of Appeal, there won't be evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so there won't be any need to take up time cross-examining witnesses. The evidence now is the evidence as it always will be. And the arguments will inevitably be honed, because if you don't hone your arguments in the Court of Appeal, you get honed yourself.
And one other thing I did want to sort of take the opportunity to ask you about is the response to this case. Obviously, there was a huge amount of publicity, both in EG and in the mainstream media, to use a terrible phrase. But have some of the comments about the potential implications of this case and reactions like property breathing a sigh of relief on the judgment, have they surprised you?
I have been a bit surprised, because I don't think anybody would be able to say that Brexit has had the effect on them that the EMA can say it had, because the EMA is a creature of European law, is entirely a construct of European law, and it's for those reasons alone that the EMA came along and said, well, we're a special case, this is only going to affect us. And it was an extreme level of affecting them, and nobody will get anywhere nearer, and even EMA didn't get near enough. So I can't see how anybody stands a remote chance of getting anywhere near.
I have to say I completely disagree. I know this is an area Jonathan and I have debated before, and indeed in court. Of course it's right that the particular combination of arguments that were put forward by the agency is unlikely to come forward for another person. That's absolutely right. But most cases that are important aren't important because somebody's going to re-argue exactly the same arguments. I think that if the EMA had succeeded, that would have very, very significant commercial ramifications, because there are lots and lots and lots of organisations and companies up and down the country who will be radically affected by Brexit.
Mm.
And as a consequence of legal and regulatory changes in their own particular sphere. So no, they might not be able to argue that they're an EU agency and that they've lost their power to deal with particular property in a non-member state. But if it were the case that the concept of Brexit bringing about significant legal change could frustrate leases, then I'm sure there would be a number of other tenants who would be jumping on that particular bandwagon. And, you know, it's not just leases either, it's also contracts generally. And there's been quite a lot of commentary, and I have to say the market commentary doesn't support Jonathan's view that this is a unique case. There have been lots of people really interested to find out what impact is Brexit going to have on my contract, on my force majeure clause, for example. So I think it's got significant ramifications.
And it's obviously something the court took seriously by, as you said earlier, expediting the trial.
Yes, absolutely. The court expedited the trial, and there was an obvious recognition in all of the judges who we appeared before, including the trial judge, that this was a case of considerable significance and a considerable public interest, and there was a lot of press interest as well.
The other thing I thought it might be interesting for people to hear is you're both from the same chambers, Wilberforce chambers. What's it like taking part in a case like this and going up against someone that you know well and have worked with for such a long time?
It's really interesting. In fact, a number of people ask about this. I've known Joanne as a close working colleague and somebody I've admired, respected and had enormous affection for 22 years since she joined Chambers in 1997. I joined 2 years earlier in 1995. And then to be up against her in a case like this, knowing all her strengths, knowing all the ways that she would work was really, really interesting. I'm not sure in the short term that it was necessarily great for our relationship, but one of the factors was, and I'm sure Joanne will echo me on this, is that, of course, although we were against each other, we each had considerable teams behind us. My team was included Tom de la Mer and James Sagan from Blackstone Chambers, and also Ian Brierley and Peter Fletcher from DLA, and they all were part of the team. So it wasn't just, in fact, me against Joanne. It was a whole team against a whole team. And so in that context, it was much easier to pretend to be Joanne's adversary.
Yeah, I'd agree with Jonathan. I mean, it's not actually that unusual for barristers to appear against one another. And Jonathan and I have been against each other on previous cases, although I don't think we've done anything that's been quite this sort of high profile or of this scale. And, you know, you do have to learn how to maintain your professionalism at the same time as knowing that you get on with somebody on a personal level, and separating out those parts of your life, as it were. But I'd also like to echo what Jonathan says about having a great team. It was really fantastic. What was unusual about this case for me was working with another EU law specialist team. So we had English law specialists, myself and Jonathan Chu, and then EU law specialists, Lord Anderson QC and Zara Al-Rakabi, and supported really brilliantly by Ben Hatton's team at Clifford Chance. And that it's a great thing. It's a great thing to be part of a team, and it's a real team effort, isn't it, Jonathan?
Absolutely. And it was, and I'm sure John will agree, it was a great thing for Chambers because our Chambers had four different people in it. I was with Ema Murphy, who's a junior in our Chambers, and as Joanne said, she was with Jonathan Chu, who's also a junior in Chambers, and they also had the same issues. It wasn't, as I say, it wasn't just me against Joanne. They, as both of them were juniors in our Chambers, and both of them were against each other. So it was a Chambers professional fest.
And sadly, we couldn't have the whole team in here. It's still a relatively small studio, but we're delighted that the pair of you could come along today and discuss the case, and hopefully we can do it all again later in the year if indeed an appeal does go ahead.
Lovely.
That'd be great.